Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Mit Wieso Steuer? Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 8. Coming up on this show, we've got the ancient magic of the unconscious, crystal shop espionage, and why Miller the German house spirit demands expensive Italian tiles. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
He must be old because everyone knows it's Spanish tiles now. No one buys Italian tiles, they're all Chinese made.
I think he's thousands of years old, actually.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah, it's Spanish tiles now.
I found a book from a German woman who speaks to her house spirit.
Oh, okay.
It's literally the house. Like, his spirit embodies the beams of the house. He remembers being a tree.
Like a brownie or something?
No, well, I don't know if he uses that. A brownie's like a different thing. He's the actual house. Like, you know how Marie Kondo, she says, oh, thank you to the house.
Yeah. This and is any object she throws away.
Yeah, this is a step beyond that. This is this German lady. She sits down and she has a back and forth with this house spirit that calls itself Miller. And the house is like on an old German watermill.
Yeah.
And it took her 2 years to realize that that's how he came up with the name Miller, because it's a mill, a watermill. Like, she actually admits that in the book. Like, yeah, it took me 2 years to figure out the joke. It's like, Germans.
It's not a very good joke there, clearly.
But yeah, she has this conversation with this house spirit who has memories of being in like a birch tree, and he was cut down in like the 13th century, and he remembers being transported.
Fascinating.
He remembers like all his brothers and sisters are the other logs that were cut from his tree.
Yeah, right.
And he still has some kind of mental contact with them. Like, some of them have decomposed, some of them have burnt down.
Yep.
But he remembers all of this, and she has this back and forth with him. And it gets to the point where this house spirit, Miller, he explains how he runs the house. He's got like a whole team of underlings, because it's a hierarchy of entities that run everything. And one of them's like, I think his name's Quadron or something. And his job is to just make sure the water heater never breaks down. And when and when she finally breaks through and has a conversation with him, he's just like, I have no time for this. If I don't do this, the whole water system will break down. Everybody will freeze. You humans, you don't know nothing. And he just has to run away.
Jeez.
And he has to keep control of this. Like, he has to actually make sure the water's flowing 24/7. This guy gets no rest. He gets no holidays.
It's about to be incredibly pissed off if you see what's going on in Germany with fuel at the moment.
Yeah, he's got his work cut out for him. He's probably passed out from stress, this poor spirit that's in charge of the water system of the house.
Look, it sounds like a really fascinating story. And the reason why I kind of got quite intrigued there was because it's going to dovetail really nicely with what we've got coming up in the Plus extension, because I continued into this theme of where we were looking at last week with Bourgier and his idea about these portals around the earth.
Yes.
Kind of descended into Rendlesham Forest, and Rendlesham Forest being one of these locations around the world which has a very high concentration of interdimensional portals, essentially.
It's We never got to hear the Fishman story that episode or the Plus episode.
I will go into the Fishman. I will finally reveal the very uneventful Fishman story. But what it got me into was this idea of basically it's not entirely portals as a way that these things enter our world. They can use other mediums to enter into our reality. And one of those mediums is, of all things, and I know it sounds very New Agey, but crystals, right? So I started looking, and I've been to places, Ben, that you wouldn't believe today. I've been to places like mysticalwonders.org forums, openenlightenment.com forums. I've been to Clarity of Being. I've been to all these forums you can imagine.
Did you create an account and impersonate, basically pretend to be a crystal shop
operator?
I did have to
create an account for a couple of, to pull some of these wild stories out. But ultimately, it comes down to this, this scene. Like, spiritual forums was another example of this. But there's this really strange world of people that believe that crystals not only are utilized for trapping entities. And
yeah, we've heard that before. We've covered that before.
Yeah, we've covered that before. New Dawn magazine, you know, covered that great story of the guy that, remember how he had the crystal and he was passing around his class and everyone would yell into the crystal?
Yeah.
And there was an entity inside the crystal, like a knight.
And he could dispel the entity by throwing the crystal into a fire cauldron.
Yeah, that's right.
The entity would be passed on.
Well, there's a whole heap of these stories out there of these people that genuinely believe that these crystals do have entities inside them, and they create these really strange relationships with them. But sometimes, and I feel like this is more of a Tulpic thing, I wonder if it's just the belief generates something, but it allows things to come through. But what did come up quite frequently, and I'm going into old shaman stories, you know, there's this, the Australian clever men with the Aboriginals,
cool.
That kind of joins in with stories that come from Asia with shamanism throughout Tibet and throughout China. Essentially what it is that these entities, it all comes down to elementals. And these elementals are in trees, they're in woodlands, they're in nature locations, and they're in rocks and stones and crystals. And so people pick them up and take them home and unleash it into their home, which causes a whole heap of all these, and they're all apparently elementals, according to some of these reports.
That's another thing, the house spirit, like that poor spirit that's looking after the water heater, he has to deal with that now. Like he's got to deal with these spirits that have been released into the house.
Yeah, these people bringing things into their homes and not realizing, and I've got this incredibly great story of essentially a guy that was traveling around the world collecting oddities, which I think is really cool. Like it's got kind of a psychometric feel to it or a psychometry feel to it, where he collected all these objects. And unfortunately, one of these objects had a very, very angry spirit trapped inside it, and it got released upon his death. So all of that will be revealed in the Plus extension towards the end of the show. But Ben, let's jump into it.
I found another intriguing book this morning, which is where I started this week. It's a new one from Daniel Lieberman. He's a psychiatrist, a great author. His previous book was on dopamine.
All right.
A really successful book on dopamine. I don't have the title in front of me, but
I'll put it in the show notes. We'll find it.
But this new one's called Spellbound, Modern Science, Ancient Magic, and the Hidden Potential of the Unconscious Mind. And through this, I got into the whole animism content and panpsychism, the idea that objects can be imbued with
a
spirit.
Consciousness.
Everything has some kind of consciousness embedded within it. And he starts off writing about the differences between the ego and the unconscious mind. And he points out that there's this idea that the unconscious can process information much more efficiently than the ego, than the conscious mind. So he's saying, listening to this sentence I'm reading to you right now, for example, that'll take 45 bits per second of brain power to process. So that doesn't leave much room because the maximum amount that the ego, the I, can process is supposedly between 10 and 60 bits of information per second.
Right, okay.
So just listening to me tell you this sentence, you don't have much bandwidth to do anything else. And this is why multitasking is a scam. You can't really do it. You've got to focus on one thing at a time. But that limitation, he says, is only on the conscious mind. So the brain as a whole, and I don't know how they calculate this. I think this is probably nonsense. But they say that the brain capacity, like mental activity, could be more than 11 million bits per second.
Is this one of those like you only use 10% of your brain kind of things?
Yes, but apparently there's some science behind this. But again, I don't know how you come to that conclusion. So the whole point is your unconscious is supposedly handling much, 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 much more than the conscious mind is, obviously, because you think about the general housekeeping of the body, you know, keeping your blood pumping, keeping your heart going, keeping your breathing going. That's all unconscious. All that is running unconsciously.
But it's also autonomic as well. It's just like it's built in.
Yeah, it's just running like a clock. But for example, he says, when you speak consciously, you know what you want to say, but you have to rely on your unconscious to supply the words. And he says, most of the time your unconscious cooperates, but not always, which, you know, that really, you know, that feeling, it sucks when you've got something on the tip of your tongue and the vocabulary just doesn't come. The ego, he says, knows what it wants, but the unconscious is just like, no, sorry, not getting it today. Doesn't deliver the word. He says sometimes the unconscious delivers a word the ego doesn't like. So it might give something insensitive that's not quite right.
Moist.
And yeah, moist just pops in your head, doesn't it?
It's just there.
Just always there. He says at those times, the ego can exercise its veto power and try and find something different. You know, like you're talking to someone and there's something going through your head of what you actually think of them. And you know, you just don't say it out loud. He says, occasionally, though, the unconscious delivers something quite different from what the ego intended, and the ego doesn't notice it.
Oh,
and
this is
where we get the term the Freudian slip.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about this case where there was a college professor, and there were all these, like, I don't want to say Me Too accusations, but there was accusations that he was favoring men in his grading. And this was vehemently denied. He said this was ridiculous. And this all kind of boiled over when he handed out his exams, like this was exam time. And he wrote on the exam, a pen is required for this test. But he forgot to put a space between the word pen and it.
Penis is required.
it said a penis is required for this test. It didn't help him out. I just thought that was a funny example. I don't even know if that's true. It's probably not. So his point with this is that it's not unusual for the unconscious to get us into trouble. And Jung actually wrote about this specifically, saying that the contents of our unconscious behave like Descartes' devils and seem to delight in playing impish tricks. They slip just the wrong word into one's mouth. They make one forget the name of the person one is about to introduce.
Yes.
They cause a tickle in the throat just when the softest passage is being played at the piano concert. They make the tiptoeing latecomer trip over a chair with a resounding crash.
Mm-hmm.
That's happened to me several times.
I feel like that happens to me all the time.
Everyone can relate to that.
Yeah, I feel like my brain deliberately sabotages me.
Or when we're at a really boring conference and we don't want to be too rude and leave within 3 minutes. So Aaron and I are like, okay, I'm going to go first, then you wait, and then you follow. But then
you
tiptoe out.
Yeah, all
but
the
then
chairs.
You get to the door and the door's like.
Or it's one of those press doors. I remember one time trying to sneak out of a conference and it had one of those press doors and I'm trying to press it and I'm like rattle, rattle, rattle. And everyone's looking. And it was like resonating through at the hall.
Like, don't mind me. I just find this incredibly boring. I'm just, this is my job. It's nothing personal. So he talks about the unconscious being so powerful, though. It's so different from conscious thought. But listen to the language he uses when he talks about it being activated. He says the experience, it can be as a kind of possession, a visitation from a foreign entity that can feel friendly, hostile, or a little of both. He says when the unconscious makes its presence felt, Jungian psychologists call it an eruption, an invasion, or incursion into consciousness. Sometimes these eruptions are destructive, producing overwhelming emotions that cloud rational judgment, destructive impulses that may ruin a person's life, and desires that run counter to the values of the conscious mind, and they're all accompanied by an irresistible pressure to fulfill them.
I know he's describing it as being Jungian, but it also has like this feeling of it could go down the path of it being demonic. It's like something coming in. It could be spirit possession.
Thank you. That's why I said pay attention to the language. This guy is a psychiatrist. And I was excited in reading this book because it felt like he was stepping outside of the, I guess, mainstream view of the mind and entertaining the idea that when we're talking about the unconscious, we may be talking about a separate entity entirely.
Or a separate, remember that secondary ego that I was describing?
Yeah, the daemon, some kind of assistant spirit, for example, an assistant soul. He talks about intuition, insight coming out of nowhere. He says it sometimes feels like a gift from the gods. Again, this language. And further on, he talks about this idea of divine possession. He says the ancient Greek theologian Clement of Alexandria compared man to a Trojan horse, saying, embracing as he does in one body a host of such different spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound like some unconscious part of your brain, or does that sound like some external, separate entity?
Mm-hmm.
He said, depending on one's circumstances, different behaviors, even different personalities come to the surface. So we really get the sense that this unconscious is separate. Maybe it's even multiple separates, multiple different things that can take charge of our bodies and minds. And he starts talking about addictions. He mentions alcoholism. He talks about how often this is called the thirsty demon. Again, there's all these clues in the language. One strategy the thirsty demon, he says, uses to get its way is the production of craving. And craving diminishes the ego's ability to make voluntary choices, as we know. sometimes a personality fragment gets its way with an addict by simply seizing control. And he says many smokers have found themselves puffing on a cigarette with no memory of taking it out of the pack.
It's
like something else is driving. It becomes automatic,
also,
an unconscious process.
Well, it does become an unconscious process, but it simply just could be that people aren't, it becomes a habit, so they're not paying attention to what they're doing.
Another example is the way sexual arousal can affect people's behavior and choices. And they've done studies on this. The one he references is the University of Windsor, their psychology department. They did a study where they showed a bunch of volunteers very sexually explicit video clips. Why doesn't he just say porn? They just showed them porn. And they showed other participants just neutral videos. When the study subjects later played a computerized game of blackjack, the ones who were sexually aroused showed a greater willingness to make risky plays. So if they had a boner from watching the porn, they were like, 19, hit me. 20, hit me. 21, hit me.
Yeah, interesting.
Like, well, I mean,
there would be a biochemical reason for that as well, because it would cause, you know, a rush of dopamine. It would increase neurotransmitters, so that would cause you to become more reckless. That all kind of makes sense.
Yeah, they're saying the argument, though, is that once the contents of the unconscious are activated, like it's stimulating the reproductive instinct, the behavior isn't entirely directed by the ego anymore. The behavior is controlled by something else. Agents, he says, that exist outside the sphere of conscious control.
It's quite a dangerous and slippery slope, though, when you think about it, because if you're implying that, you know, one type of stimulus can affect you and cause you to lose control, well, then from, you know, even a legal standpoint, imagine what kind of impact that would have. You know, that you're not in control because you've been stimulated by something.
Yeah, and again, you look at our language, like what on earth possessed her to do that?
Yes.
And what could have got into him? These expressions, they acknowledge that there's forces outside of us, there's forces beyond our control. But then he makes a great point saying that these forces also give us great gifts. He's got a quote from the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, who says, "I familiarize myself with the factual data of a theoretical and practical problem. I then do not think about it again. Yet often a few days later, the answers to the problem will come into my mind entirely from its own accord. The operation which produced it, however, remains as much a mystery to me as that of an adding machine." He has no idea where it comes from. And the same thing from the mathematician Henri Poincaré, who says that at the moment when I put my foot on the step, the idea came to me without anything in my former thoughts seeming to have paved the way for it. And he's talking about like Fuchsian functions and non-Euclidean geometry, like some complex thing just popped into his head when he stepped onto his, you know, step to go into his house or something. So we hear this all the time from creative people, that inspiration comes out of nowhere. Creative people describe themselves as bystanders. They don't know where these new ideas, where these new solutions came from. They came out of nowhere.
But is that necessarily coming from an external source? I mean, the number of times that, you know, you and I both experienced where you just can't focus on something and you can't really, you know, get your head around something. You step away from it, and then all of a sudden afterwards, when you're not focusing on it, there again, the unconscious steps in, that it somehow blossoms for you. It's like by stepping away from it. But is that just simply a subconscious process that's somehow inherent to human beings, or is there something else that could be influencing that?
I think it's something else. The argument is that, the conventional argument is that you're collecting all this data somewhere and the unconscious is storing it somewhere deep within the brain. But the reality is we don't know how memories work. We don't know how memories are stored. That none of that is really well understood. And it seems as though if you were collecting all this information like a great library, you should be able to just go in like a library and pull it out on demand. But that's never how it works.
Mm.
And the great ideas like that previous example of the German philosopher, he's saying he doesn't know what operation produced it. He doesn't understand where it came from because he wasn't even thinking about the problem. The answer came out of nowhere. And you can think about that from artistic pursuits as well. It's the same kind of thing. But he says that when an idea is inspired, the unconscious provides not only the idea, but it's important to note you get the energy and the motivation to pursue the idea. So that's, you know, the famous thing where people become consumed by it. Like artists will work day and night with no food and no sleep, and they won't shower to complete the project that they suddenly have the inspiration for. It gives you this energy as well. And again, you look at the language behind it, the origin of the words, and I feel like there's some kind of truth to it. It's not just a coincidence that they all talk about this. They all mention this same concept. Like what they're filled with is enthusiasm. And he points out that if you trace the root of the word, it's from the Greek entheos, which translates to possessed by a god.
Okay, so it's got a positive ring to it as well.
Yeah, this is the idea of where the inspiration comes from. It's
not
divine. It's not from some collection of all this knowledge over your lifetime that suddenly bubbles to the surface. It's directly inspired by another agent.
Well, I mean, you can't rule out the possibility of, you know, human beings having these innate unknown abilities. Like, you shouldn't just completely eliminate and say, well, no, it's got to be external, because I think the human mind is capable of such incredible things. So to give it agency to another outsider entity.
Is it? Is the human mind capable of such creative things? I mean, that's just a presumption. We're just presuming that.
You're right. I am presuming that. But at the same time, I like to have faith that humanity is capable of doing that. Although if you've recently seen contemporary art, then I would go against that. So maybe that's the reason why art has become so terrible, because like we've become so materialistic that we've lost that connection to these entities or these divine things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like it always comes from somewhere. Like, human beings obviously have their own will and agency, and they apply their own, you know, ideas and desires to things. But there's always an origin for an idea or a thought that comes from somewhere else. I feel like things come from somewhere else. And this is what Swedenborg would always talk about, the idea that humans were influenced by either something higher or something lower. And all their job was to do was to figure out which way to go in the moment, which decision to make.
You don't give any credit at all to the possibility that you could just take in vast amounts of information and not require it or need it, but with enthusiasm, and then you start thinking, well, I need to focus on this and I need an idea or I need a solution, that your brain is so advanced that in some way it could generate that for you later on?
No, I don't think humans are that capable.
Okay.
I don't think humans are that capable. I think we can gather lots of knowledge, and there's unique situations where we can use that knowledge, obviously. But what I'm talking about are moments of breakthroughs that baffle the people that are meant to be the experts, who don't understand where it came from. You look at, like, what are the DNA guys, Watson and Crick?
Yeah.
Like that, almost like a divine inspiration where they have a vision of where it comes from. And they don't describe it as a culmination of all their knowledge coming together in this one point. They say it came to them in a vision.
Yeah.
It's like it just plopped into their head. If you listen to creative people and inventors and people that have these kinds of experiences, they don't describe it in a way that sounds like it's just, well, I collected all this knowledge and finally put it all together after a good night's sleep. It's almost like it's placed into their head. But so to go on with what Lieberman's saying, he talks about what he says, that, well, there's stories about powerful entities who are mysterious and cloaked in darkness, which is what makes me interested in what this book is about, because it sounds like he's getting to this idea, which I prescribe to, that there are separate agents that are influencing these ideas.
So you almost mean it's like, you know, the devil and the angel on your shoulders.
Yeah. I think that's a really good way to describe it. He says they're morally ambiguous, though. Sometimes they help humans, often in astounding ways, but sometimes they harm as readily as they help. They have rules of their own that can be learned by those who are unfortunate or fortunate enough to stumble into their realm. So he starts talking about Western culture and magic. And he points out that something we talk about all the time, that Western culture has become
corrupted,
infatuated with the rational world, with materialism, with the ego since the Enlightenment, particularly with science. Like, the scientific endeavor has been so successful, he says, that many people believe we will master the world through calculation and achieve an earthly paradise in which all our needs are met. But humans have needs that go beyond the material. And he says science doesn't help with the development of our inner world. It only has tools to control our environment, the outer world. Science may tempt us to seek a life of safe, controlled predictability, but he says that, you know, that doesn't really lead to happiness. It doesn't work that way. And there's no kind of correlation with happiness and material wealth. It's kind of fleeting.
It helps.
It helps for some things, but it's fleeting. It's not long lasting. What we need are the immaterial things, the non-material things, love, friendship, beauty, creativity, and growth. And he says science doesn't really help us with those things. And he says suppressing the magical instinct that comes from the unconscious may appear sensible in this age of scientific rationalism, but it cuts us off from an important part of our humanity. And he actually says that magic is what we live for if you stop and think about it. If you examine the way humans behave, we live for this magic, this immaterial world. So one example he uses, and I think we've heard this before on a different segment, but people like to mention this guy, I think because he's on TV, Lucas Congdon, America's most famous swimming pool builder. I've never seen this guy's show. Have you seen this guy's show?
No, not that I know of.
He's got a company called Lucas Lagoons, and they build like really unique, creative looking pools and natural rock lagoons. They're like industry leaders. And apparently there's been an award-winning TV show on Animal Planet about him since 2015, like a reality TV show about his company. Never
he
seen it.
I never pools.
He's just a pool guy.
All right.
But he's from a family of stonemasons. And the reason he gets brought up, because I think we've mentioned him before, is he says he loves working with rocks. Like he always, but when he's searching for rocks for the pools he builds, he actually goes out into nature and he says he tries to listen to the rocks. So he goes out and he actually talks to the rocks. He said, like in one of the clips, he'll look at a rock and go, talk to me. Just talk to me. And, you know, the camera will pan to the rock. It's just obviously sitting there. And he says, he'll lean into it and be like, what do you want to be, silly little rock? Tell me what you want to be. And he says people think he's obviously a little nuts because he talks to rocks. But this guy is an award-winning designer. His pool designs are the best in the world, apparently. So you shouldn't write it off and think that he's crazy. And so this is where Lieberman says the evidence suggests that the unconscious circuits in his brain help him build better pools by inspiring him to see the world from that magical perspective, one in which rocks are alive and can talk to him. He does better work when he treats his rocks as friends rather than just construction materials. But if you read between the lines, like Lieberman is all talking about unconscious circuits and it's all about this guy's brain. It's almost like Lieberman saying he's tricking himself into thinking that he's talking to the rocks.
Yep.
And this is where I started to realize, oh, this guy, this psychiatrist, he's talking about going beyond materialism and how this magical thinking is very advantageous and how we can tap into the unconscious, but he's still a materialist. He still thinks it comes from the unconscious mind. He still thinks it's from our meat machine. It's neurons firing away. That's what we need to tap into. It's all just the brain. He doesn't actually believe that there's anything to this stuff.
Isn't it fascinating though, how it's so similar to what we hear of modern psychologists that approach spirit possession of going, well, I don't believe that there's anything going on with it. However, if I approach it from that perspective, it's always effective. Like it seems to have an effective outcome. And they're still like going, well, there's a possibility that there's a separate consciousness that is, oh no, it's all generated by the brain.
I'm getting really sick of this approach. It's
because they can't.
It's so milquetoast.
It is, but they can't. If you're, think about it. I mean, in Australia, I don't know what it's like in the rest of the world, but psychology alone, let alone, you know, psychiatry, you've got to be like spend 6 years at university and then you've got to do an internship. Like it's a lot of work. Imagine going through all that and all of a sudden going against, you know, mainstream, you know, psychological understanding that it's all within the brain. They can't.
Why not?
Because they can't. Because they're not.
Why can't they?
Because people will be struck off the register.
Because they have to give things up. Well, sometimes you got to give things up to tell the truth.
Well, I think there needs
to be. You've got to sacrifice.
There needs to be a paradigm shift, though. And I just think at the way that we are at the moment as a society, it's going to be very difficult for that paradigm shift to take place.
Yeah, it's interesting that he's talking about all the things that I would find myself agreeing with, but in the end he's like, well, isn't that interesting how when we trick ourselves to think that the world is actually immaterial, then we have all these amazing advantages. I'm like, no, we're not tricking ourselves. That's just wisdom. We're understanding the truth of nature. We're tapping into what's real. Now, he does give some scientific experiments where psychologists have looked at this. There's Eugene Subutsky from the University of Lancaster in England. He was wondering what happens to that magical point of view as we get older, because this is how children think. Children think that the world is animated. That's why in...
Yeah, they do.
The first time...
I love it.
When we see animism today in our culture, we see it in children's cartoons. Like it's in, you know, Disney with a broom coming alive or something. Like you, that's how you see it. That's how we're exposed to it. But he, this psychologist, he started to think that adults were able to adopt a materialist perspective only by building up defenses against that magical view. It's kind of like he's arguing that that is the natural way for us to think. But as we get older, we put up these artificial restraints on that type of thinking. So this guy, he wanted to see if he could break through those defenses and bring back those old magical beliefs back to the surface with fully grown adults. So he got a group of participants in this study who he made sure they didn't believe in magic. They were full-on materialists. And he basically told them this simple story about a witch who approached a man walking down an empty street. And the witch offers to put a spell on this guy that'll make him rich and happy. And so he asks the people in the research group whether they would advise the man to accept the spell or decline it. Now, half the participants are like, oh, whatever. Yeah, I guess he should accept it. And the other half are like, well, maybe he shouldn't accept it. Like, who cares? It was basically 50-50. No one went, you know, in any significant direction. And then the story was changed so that the spell became a curse that would make the man a servant of evil forces. And he got the same results. They're like, yeah, maybe he should take the spell. But magic's not real. What difference does it make? But then this psychologist changed it very significantly. He said to the research participants, what if the witch approached you and offered a spell that would make you rich and make you happy? Would you accept or decline the spell? So now that it was personal, all the numbers changed. Over 60% of the research volunteers said they would accept the good spell. When they were faced with the bad spell that would make them a servant of evil forces, every single one of them declined. Not a single person was willing to accept that spell despite their disbelief in magic. They don't think it's real. So when it comes to practical matters, something that affects you, all of a sudden people kind of believe in magic again. And this psychologist wrote a lot about playing games of imagination with his young son. And he's probably under the age of seven. He hasn't outgrown his magical thinking. And this guy wrote, what impressed me the most in my son's attitude was his absolute confidence in the idea that nature would be kind to him, that the elements, water, air, for example, were aware of his presence in the universe, accepting his divine right to be there. And he said, as we grow into adults and lose this belief, the universe becomes a cold place governed by the impersonal laws of physics. Of course, this psychologist writes, we are in debt to science for its remarkable achievements, modern medicine, technologies, you know, comfortable lives, all that stuff. Yet the price of such comfort is great. It's the loss of a meaningful connection between man and nature. So his argument is that that's never truly gone, though. That's when we behave in the world, we still believe those things because it's something that's so intrinsic to our nature. And I think it's not because we're just evolved to be magical thinkers. I think it's wisdom. People have an innate wisdom about the world. So a real life example would be there was a young couple who recently moved into a new home, he talks about, and they'd been house hunting for months and they finally found this really good deal. And, you know, they locked it in for the price. They moved in. And after they moved in, they discovered that someone had been murdered in the upstairs bathroom.
Oh, nice.
Now,
was that because their spirit would wander through the house in the middle of the night?
Well, these guys were so upset, like really upset. But they weren't religious. They didn't believe in magic.
Doesn't matter. You've still got an entity potentially on your hands.
That's my point. Why would it bother them? If they were materialists, yeah, why would it bother them?
They
if,
accept the possibility, some, even possibly subconsciously, that a spirit could exist.
Yeah, well, the story has a happy ending. They ended up getting in a priest
who really
got some smoke and did like a little ceremony. And then they were really happy and thought, what a great deal we got. But there's services like that where you go online and you pay a fee and they'll tell you if someone's ever died in your house. And,
really?
And it just underlines that, you know, people are materialists. But again, when it comes to something personal, all of a sudden everyone believes in magic. Everyone believes in the spiritual. Why is that?
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Why?
It's because we have this innate wisdom. We can't be fully removed from it. We can't be completely made 100% material. I guess some people can, but most people still have that little bit.
Housecreep.com.
You found one. He talks about it though as like, we're creating this idea. Like this is all this magical fantasy that we're creating. He says fire is another example of something that becomes endowed with spirit. Like it moves in unpredictable ways. Yeah. And firefighters describe it as devious and cunning. You know, what are you laughing at?
So I just put in the address of a friend's place that I know. And this is like Tennessee.
20 dead people.
It's drug lab and property damage.
Are you serious?
It's a drug lab.
That's hilarious, dude.
Former drug lab.
How well do you know this person?
Passing acquaintance. I'm going to have to send an email. So, dear not to touch, you know that your house was once a drug lab.
What kind of metaphysical consequences are there to having a meth lab in your house?
I can't even begin to imagine. That's correct. Guys, look up.
And then he talks about everyday ordinary objects can feel malicious. Like, you know how you've got a lock, you got a key, you're trying to unlock a door and it just will not work.
Do you know what I know is malicious? USB-C just USB cables before they went to C, where you had to, no matter what you did,
no
matter how many times you tried to shove it in, it wouldn't work until you look at it.
Yeah, you know, it's like the lock example. You're like, you bastard. You hate the lock in the door because you think it's actually being malicious towards you. And then the other side of that thing is there's objects we have that we've owned for years and years and years, like a favorite keepsake or like a trusty old knife or something that we don't want to part with. And he says the longer an object is in contact with a human being, the more likely it is to be perceived as living. It's almost, he says, as if human minds radiate soul the way our bodies radiate heat.
Okay.
Like he says, the many hours your mother spent making that sweater she gave you, the love and care she put into it, make you feel as if she imbued it with life.
Yeah, this is the Marie Kondo stuff.
It doesn't make you feel it.
You are feeling
it. That's what it is. You are feeling a real thing. It's not your brain being tricked into thinking, oh, mum made this. So there's neurons firing in your brain going, oh, your mum made this. It's special. No, you're actually feeling a real energy. You're actually feeling something tangible that exists.
Yeah,
it's not your brain.
I've noticed it with my kids. My kids are not teddy bear kids. They're just not, for whatever reason, they don't like teddy bears. They don't hang on to them, anything. But there are these knitted little birds that my aunt made for them. And for whatever reason, they love them. They hang on to them. They've always got them around. But anything else, no interest at all. And I wonder if it's like because there was that personal love that was put into them that they must pick up on it.
And then he starts talking about the madness of crowds.
Yes.
How, like, here's an example. When you have a bunch of friends together and you start talking about something contentious, right? You're talking about politics or religion or something. The conversation becomes spirited.
Oh, yes.
Think about the language. It feels like there's another person in the room, he says, a mysterious presence driving things forward. Even places start to have feelings attached to them. That the Romans had a word for it, which was genius loci, or the spirit of the place. But today we just call it vibe. But again, it's this feeling of spirit. The actual place has a tangible feeling of spirit. And he points out how pre-industrial societies had this animistic understanding of the world. They understood that things were alive, that things had mind, things had consciousness. You had to be on good terms with the spirits of the land, of the house, of the river. And Joseph Campbell has a quote from an Apache storyteller who said, the plants, rocks, fire, water are all alive. They watch us and see our needs. They see when we have nothing to protect us. And it is then that they reveal themselves and speak to us. And the Buddhists call this phenomenon the sermon of the inanimate. And he has this whole section where he's like, well, what does this mean? You know, what does this mean for psychology? And what is the brain trying to tell us? And I'm like, no, it's not the brain. Your brain is processing information. It's just processing a signal. Right, it's not the source of everything.
Yeah, subscribe to the idea that the brain is simply a filter for this information, then it all makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, he ends up going into numinous experiences. You know how people describe altered states of consciousness, strange, spontaneous moments of enlightenment when they're out in nature and they can't describe it in words. And eventually he gets onto how people describe it as realer than real.
Yes, you hear that near-death experiences quite frequently.
And again, there's this interesting point where he's like, the unconscious mind is doing something to enhance our perception. And I'm just, again,
why
can't,
so,
they just can't get past it.
But why are you so averse to the possibility of it being the brain? Like, if we could entertain the possibility that the brain is...
Because it's meaningless. Because it's meaningless.
Why is it meaningless?
Well, if you believe that everything is produced by meat in your skull.
And neurochemistry and electrical impulses and
there's
that's
no
it.
Meaning.
Mm, yeah, I like that. That's philosophical.
What's the point?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Well, but and this is the thing though. This is for some people, you know, I actually feel quite, you know, sorry for them because you don't necessarily have to be religious, but I think entertaining the possibility of the brain, you know, this not being it, if you subscribe to the idea that there's nothing else, it becomes very nihilistic for some people. Imagine and I think it creates depression.
Imagine thinking that everything you experience is just little electrons in your meat, in your brain, firing away. That's all that reality is. That's all that the universe is. We'd have to change the name of the show. It wouldn't be Mysterious Universe.
It'd be Electrical Universe.
It'd be Boring, Boring Universe. Let's change the show to Boring Universe and we'll just talk about brain psychology.
So this person,
we'll just talk about
neuroscience. A ghost, but it actually wasn't a ghost. It was a firing of 7 milliamps in the back of the hippocampus.
If there's a neuroscientist listening to this and you're just getting really angry because you totally disagree, start your own show, call it Boring Universe. We'll see how you go. And again, when we look at how people behave, we live this way. Like if you actually believed that you just had neurons firing in your brain, even if people think that's what happens, they still don't follow through and they still live believing in magic. Like people believe in superstition. People
yes,
believe in
absolutely.
Magic.
Yep.
He talks about sportsmen with their superstitions. Like, you know how Michael Jordan always wore his college shorts.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Under his Chicago Bulls uniform.
Like, yeah, right.
Apparently every game he played in the NBA.
Like a good luck charm.
He was wearing those crappy little stinky blue shorts from his college days as a good luck charm. And Tom Brady, you know, the quarterback, he carried protection stones. he carried protection stones while he was playing.
What do you mean protection stones? As in like crystals?
Little protection stones from a crystal shop.
Oh like, my God.
Tom Brady is meant to be like a badass, you know, super Chad quarterback.
He's like, oh, I'm going to have my protection stones.
And yet, you know what's even sadder? His wife gave them to him.
Oh, but that's the whole like,
no, it's
love
lame.
And attention.
No, yeah. It's lame. It's super lame. Tom Brady's a loser.
If they start breathing, he knows he needs to run. That's actually a story I have coming up.
Oh, cool. Okay, so when researchers have actually, again, he's a science guy, so he gives these examples. People have studied this. So one example was they got all these participants together and they were meant to make 10 putts from a distance of 100 centimeters, so pretty easy. But when they were given a ball, one group of people were told, oh, here's the lucky ball. Everyone's been doing well with this ball. And then they would go and putt with it. And then with other people, they were just like, oh, here's the ball everyone's been using. So the people that were told it was the lucky ball, they sank the ball on average like 6.42 times out of the 10 shots.
So that must just be some psychological quirk though, right? It's
no, it's because they believe the ball is better. The ball has power. It's the lucky ball.
Mm.
Performs better. See, if you're just given the normal ball, they only got it in like 4.7% of the time. There's a story of the NCAA bowling champion, John Hinkle Jr. He took this lucky ball concept to the next level. His father had died before he was going in a tournament or something. And he filled his bowling ball with his father's ashes.
Oh, that's a bit much.
Why?
That's a bit much.
Because he's rolling around in there, he's going to get a headache.
Yeah, that's, I don't know why. He's
going to get dizzy.
I mean, if his father agreed beforehand, but I don't know, it feels a little bit disrespectful.
It is a bit disrespectful, isn't it?
Yeah.
But maybe if his father was a bowler and that was their thing together, yeah, look, and they whatever. Grew up doing if bowling, yep. like this, it's a personal thing. So he did this and he went on to bowl a perfect game.
So and like I guess it would have created some type of magic for him, right? Because of the connection to his father.
Yeah, perfect game's rare. Yeah, very, very hard,
isn't it?
But the interesting thing was he said by the last frame, he was crying so much he couldn't even see where the ball was going. And he still got a strike on the last frame.
But surely, Ben, right? Surely. It's just because you're believing in something, it somehow removes a constraint upon you. Maybe it's not that there's magic. It's just simply, as you said earlier there, we set up these constraints in these restrictions. And by utilizing the concept of magic, you remove that restriction. Could it be that?
I don't think these examples are really good examples of underlining my point. I'm just throwing them in because they're mildly interesting stories.
Well, yeah, look, I think where your point though really is, highlighted is in extreme cases such as the third man effect, which is even like that's the upper end of of an example of
it.
Well,
I mean, the evidence is everything else we talk about on the show.
Yes,
like it's near death experiences, it's out of body experiences, it's altered states of consciousness, it's all that stuff. It's veridical experiences that are observed by multiple people.
It's trapping a poltergeist in your yoni egg.
Exactly. And
another story coming up.
That story's. I cannot wait for that. So he then talks about how our unconscious is smarter. Like they've done experiments where, and I think we've gone into this a little bit. Remember that segment I did on how the body is more intelligent than the mind?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They've done experiments where, say, you're moving to a new city and you're looking for a house. You need one close to work. You need one for your family, but it can't cost more than $350,000. So your agent shows you three homes. You've got one beautiful one. It's 10 minutes from your office, but it costs $425,000. So that's out of the picture. Second one's almost big enough. It's 30 minutes from your office. It costs $300,000. And the third one has plenty of room. It's 15 minutes from your office and it's $335,000. So out of those three, your conscious mind is like, easy. Like that's an easy decision for your conscious mind. But researchers at the University of Amsterdam, they did an experiment where they asked volunteers to consider four apartments and they had to choose which was the best. And each apartment had 12 different features that they needed to evaluate. And so this was like, this is 48 pieces of detailed information they have to sort through, and they presented it all randomly. Now, the designers of the experiment set it up so that there is objectively one apartment that is the best. Like, absolutely, you can't deny it. It's the best. And one of them is the worst. Like, there's no way you would choose it if you're in your right mind. So they divide the participants into three groups. The first group is told, you got to just make a decision immediately. Like, you've got 10 seconds to make a decision. The second group was given 3 minutes to think about it. And the final group was distracted for 3 minutes and then they had to make a decision. And that last group, they were solving anagrams or something. So the whole idea with the last group is that their conscious mind is completely taken out of the picture because there's no more bandwidth for it to do anything. They can't even think about the apartments. So the people that were like, bang, immediate decision, they were just as likely to choose the good one as the worst one. Like they were just totally random. They were so overloaded with information. It was just like 50-50. The group that had to deliberate on 3 minutes.
Without doing anything, just
thinking about it for 3 minutes. Yep. They were just as bad.
Mm.
Like just as bad. In fact, I think they were worse than the like instant reaction people. And the group that obviously did the best were the ones that were distracted for 3 minutes. And the idea is that their conscious mind, their unconscious made the decision because the unconscious.
Their ego was suspended.
Their ego's gone. The assistant mind, the unconscious, the daemon is like, yeah, well, obviously that's the best house because it's more capable than our conscious mind.
It's surprising though when you think about it because you get the outcome for the instantaneous choice. But when you've got 3 minutes to consciously think about it, you would think that you would make, the best decision, but clearly not.
And they've done this with other purchases. Like researchers in Amsterdam studied this where they looked at whether it's buying a bottle of shampoo or something complicated like a computer or a camera. They found that with simple purchases, extensive conscious analysis led to greater satisfaction. So if it's just like a stick of deodorant, yeah, if you sit there and think about it, you'll pick the best one. But if it's something complicated like a camera or, you know, a car, the more time you spend thinking about it, the less satisfied you'll be. And they've actually proven this. Apparently they've proven this. And this is against common sense because you would think, again, it's like if I gather all this information, it's like the argument of gathering all this information to make a scientific discovery. If I gather all this information, I'll make the best decision. I'll come to the right conclusion. Well, that doesn't work in real life. Sometimes the unconscious is better suited for the job. If you just go on gut reaction, they've done this experiment with art as well, where they got people to buy art. One group was told to just do it on gut feeling, and another group was told, okay, you've got a day to think about it. You know, you've got a couple of hours to choose the best art piece. And then they come back to them after like 3 months and they say, what do you think about your decision? And the people that were just like, gut reaction, that's the one, they had satisfaction. Like they loved what they got. The people that deliberated on it, consciously thought about whether this was what they want hanging in their house, hated what they bought.
Wow.
Hated their art piece.
Yeah.
So I'm doing renovations in my house at the moment. I'm redoing the bathroom. And my wife and I, we've kind of done this where we're just like, oh, whatever, yeah, that'll do. we're not really...
And it looks great.
We're not interior thinking people. Like we don't really care what our bathroom looks like. So we just go like, yeah, that sounds good. Get that. Yeah, well, it's just gut feeling.
I recently renovated mine. I spent 2 months working out tiles, you know, what I was going to do. I walk into my bathroom and I fucking hate it.
Yeah, that's...
I hate it.
That's what happens. This is what the research is saying. The more you think about it, the less satisfied you are.
I spent hours going to, like, there's this tile shop down the road, they're really great, but I went down there and I laid everything out and I was there for hours on end. I went back 3 or 4 times. I went to another shop and I'm like, geez, I hate this. Like, at first, I went, oh, it's funny. New, it looks great. Now I'm just like, I wish you'd do it.
Yeah. Any kind of creative decision, just don't make it rational. Just be pure gut feeling. And I know this is so counterintuitive because especially with cars and complex things, you want to research them.
Yeah.
But the science says... And we want to trust the science, don't we?
Yeah. It's settled, Ben.
It says that you have to kind of just go off gut.
You know what, though?
And that's why I have a ridiculous-looking Honda Civic parked outside that looks like a Japanese toy because I went off gut feeling.
It makes sense, though. Think about it. It makes sense because your gut reaction is kind of like inherently what you're going to like. Like, think about it. It's just what you're going to like. And the more you think about it, the more you move away from your gut, then... It's like the mind kind of clouds everything. It overwhelms the gut, but the gut and it's like the ego kind of, I think, cloud stuff.
So let me bring all this back to a final point, and then we'll talk about this crazy German lady with her house spirits. He points out that all this is showing that intuition is an advantage. This gut feeling, this thinking without the conscious mind, it's an advantage. And some people are more intuitive than others. And they've actually designed experiments where you can detect how intuitive someone is. So one of them is they have this square that appears on a screen, and it's either in, you know, the top left, the top right. Randomly appearing in one of the corners. Mm-hmm. And there's a pattern to it. Now, if you start and you've got to press a button when it appears in each corner, like you've got to anticipate where it's going to be. But there's a pattern that they're not told about. And eventually people figure out the pattern.
So you subconsciously learn it or you just...
But yeah, they unconsciously figure out the pattern.
Right.
If you tell people there's a pattern and they start trying to find it, they actually get worse at the activity.
Really?
So
again, the mind or the ego clouding.
Yeah, when the ego gets involved, it actually makes your performance worse. So the researchers... did some pretests with this and that's where they figured out that if you let people know, they can't do it as well. So essentially they created a problem that was best solved with intuition. So if you use your intuition, you're supreme at this, this activity. And obviously some people are more intuitive than others and they're really good at this activity. So they had created an experiment that could essentially measure intuition. So what they did, building on this, is they came up with essentially a study that looked at belief. So they got participants who believe in divine intervention. They believe in God, right? They believe in some kind of higher power. And they compared the results of those people to atheists and people that don't believe in those things. And they found that the volunteers who were more intuitive were the ones that had belief in God, were the ones that had strong beliefs in a higher power, ones that believe they have this magic thinking. The ones that were atheists performed much poorly, much worse at this intuitive task. Now, they thought this might be cultural, so they actually went to Afghanistan. They went to Kabul to repeat this test with Afghanis. And it was the same results. The individuals who believed in Allah, inshallah, they were better. They were more intuitive than the ones who didn't. So it shows.
But clearly it's not just religion, though. You could be agnostic or spiritual, have an idea or a belief that there's more to the material world.
It's belief in a higher power.
Right.
Yeah. So it's belief. Again, it's the way they word it is divine intervention.
Right. Okay.
But again, I pulled away from this book because the whole vibe of it is, well, isn't that interesting what the brain does? Mm. Isn't that interesting how the brain makes you behave that way? Isn't it interesting how your unconscious does this when we convince ourselves that, you know, gods are real or that we believe in a higher power? It's frustrating that they can't go a step beyond this. Because once the mind is open to the fact that, well, maybe people are performing better when they believe in God is because there is a higher power. There are other dimensions. There are things outside of our material world. There is something beyond the brain. Thoughts and ideas don't necessarily come from the meat thing in our head.
I must say, and I'm not ragging on atheists. I mean, believe whatever you want, but I do find it fascinating, certainly within our field, Ben, when I see, particularly on social media, because obviously some of these people, like, they're very vocal about, you know, like, oh, it's all garbage and, you know, none of it's real beyond the brain. And yet they engage in going on ghost hunts.
Yeah.
And I'm like, do you see the problem here?
It's a fun, kitschy thing to do. Yeah, I mean, each to their own, but I'm frustrated with the thinking. It feels like shackled thinking. Like you're stuck in this paradigm that the brain producing everything.
It's inherent with materialism, though. It's completely coupled with it.
It's still materialism. If you think that, you know, we're convincing ourselves of this metaphysical world and it's creating something in the neurons in our unconscious mind that's created by the brain, you're still a materialist.
Mm.
So, I mean, it's interesting. There's a lot more to the book, so I might be writing the guy off. Maybe in the last chapter he's like, and this is why I believe in God. Maybe that's, I didn't finish it. To Lieberman's credit, it is really interesting. It's called Spellbound: Modern Science, Ancient Magic, and the Hidden Potential of the Unconscious Mind. Later on, he goes into the magic of fairy tales. It's really fascinating. He goes into why the old fairy tales do certain things to the mind, what they teach us. He talks about archetypes and, you know, Jung, obviously, yeah, quite a bit. But it is really interesting, especially how stories they shape the listener in a way that no other medium can.
Mm.
Like, they do things to your mind that nothing else can do. So and that's important because, you know, that's what we do on the show.
You know, despite actually, you know, referencing him quite a lot, I haven't read a large amount of, you know, Jung's personal ideas, obviously from his psychological standpoint I had. But I was thinking about it. Was Jung, like, still very psychological? Like, didn't he dismiss some of this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much in the dark with a lot of it as well. But the feeling I get is that still the idea is it's unconscious. It's an unconscious mind. It's still the mind.
It's not external.
Whether that extends into fully this materialist idea that's just the brain, I'm not sure. I don't think so. Mm. But that's certainly the feeling you get from most thinkers that follow this kind of idea.
It's a shame, though, because I wonder if, you know, even referencing those studies or those, you know, those little experiments, I know they're only very small, so it doesn't give us a great indication. However, you know, if people kind of approach the world with this more, you know, magical openness, I wonder if it would make things better. Like, I wonder if it would improve things. Like, would it?
Of course it would.
And does it add consequence? Like, you don't have to be religious or spiritual to be ethical, but I wonder if you've got that additional layer of, well, you might be punished on the other side for something you do. Would that change the way that we live in this world?
Yeah, it keeps people in check.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's something to it.
So let's go into, because I love this idea of the animism, right? Of things being alive, objects being alive. So I went into this book that I've been sitting on for a while. The author's name is Verena Stahl von Holstein. It was written in German back in the 2000s, but translated about 10 years ago by Wolfgang Virok. It's called Nature, Spirits, and What They Say. And this lady speaks to a house. She has conversations with a house. And I wanted to read from you some of the foreword. This is by Wolfgang Virok, who's the publisher of the German outfit that put the book out. And he explains the odd way that this book came about. So he said it was late summer 2001. It was shortly before the 9/11 attacks. And this manuscript arrives, and it's from this woman, Verena von Holstein. It arrives in his office. It's called Conversations with Miller. And it was this huge thing. It was like over 500 pages of A4, like very small type, of conversations she and her husband had with nature spirits. And he's like, oh my, this is way too much for a book. Like, it's just too big. It's like 500 pages of these Q&As. So for almost a year, it just sat there in his office. He didn't do anything with it. But he said in the summer of 2002, he actually opened it and started to have a closer look at it. And he started to realize there was something to it. It didn't seem as though she was just making it up. Some of the information coming through was so strange and, you know, otherworldly. Well, it's just like, you wouldn't expect a tree spirit to be talking about the war in Iraq, for example.
What?
Okay, so basically he had massive doubts and he realizes, I got to go talk to this woman and her husband. So he books a trip and he's just like, what am I going to be running into? Like, is she going to have crystals everywhere?
Yeah, yeah.
Is she going to be like, welcome to my domain?
There's a wind chime at the front with like, all those spinny sun things
like
on it.
1,000 wind chimes. And is she a medium? Is she going to be some kind of drama queen?
It smells sage everywhere.
What is going on? So he goes and visits her and she's just this delightful, you know, very normal, down-to-earth woman. She and her husband live in this water mill. It's this beautiful scenic area in this region in northern Germany.
It's probably like one of those fairy tales that you actually imagine, you know, like the stories of the Black Forest.
Yeah, it really looks like a fairy tale setting.
Yeah.
And he visited her three times. And on his third visit, he said he spoke with the nature spirits himself. And that's why he decided to publish the book.
Okay.
So I was like, intrigued. Oh, intrigued.
Yeah.
What happened actually is that this woman translated what they were saying for him. So when I first read that, I was like, oh, did he hear them in his mind?
Yeah. Did a little goblin thing hop out like, yay!
No, none of that happened. He was just so convinced at the information that was coming through that he thought, I have to put this book out. Now, the reason he thought that, and I don't think this is obvious proof that nature spirits are real, but he said he would think of a question and the answer would come from the spirit before he'd even finished forming the thought in his mind.
Okay.
Like there was something weirdly psychic going on. And he was also convinced by the vocabulary that was coming through, the way the different personalities spoke and the information that they were giving. So I'm just going to kind of skim through this. It's a very laborious Q&A. It's like reading
a regression or something.
It's like an entire book of regressions. But essentially the whole reason these nature spirits wanted to talk to her is because something has been going on for decades in these metaphysical realms. They explain that angels, higher beings, have been their masters forever, since as long as they can remember. But now those higher beings are leaving. They're vacating the earth.
That's not good.
I know. I was like, okay, well, what's going on there? Why are they leaving us here? But take us with you.
Is it kind of corny, but is it like because we don't believe anymore?
Well, it's never really explained. These entities are just like, yeah, the angels and the higher beings, they're leaving and we're kind of left with you humans and you're our masters now. And they're apparently these entities, these nature spirits, these elementals, they're terrified because they need direction. They need direction. And yet humans are retards and don't know what's going on and have no idea that they even exist. So these entities are like, what are we going to do? Like, we need to work with them. Otherwise, the whole world's going to fall apart and they don't even know we're here. So let's get this random German woman that lives in a water mill and we'll use her to make a book. So that's what they did. So there's a bit of a Q&A with this woman and Wolfgang at the start. And she explains, like, she's been seeing these beings, because she sees them as well, for as long as she can remember. Like, she remembers being, you know, 4 years old and just seeing them, like, moving along the bank of the river, like little elf-like creatures, like little men with beards and like little dungarees, and just thinking, oh, it's normal. Like, oh, there's the little beings. Sometimes she was scared of them because some of them look scary.
But why would you just naturally assume that that's normal? Like, why would that?
Because you're a kid. You've never known any different.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Why would you not think it's normal?
Yeah, good point. I guess so.
And she started to work eventually. Like, she never really told anyone about them. She said her grandmother mentioned that she had seen them as well, but not as clearly as Verena had. But she said they kind of faded away when she got a job in IT. She started working every day in an office in front of a computer and they started to fade out of her life.
Well, is it because of the computers or is it just because she grew up and that one of those restraints that you described started kicking in?
She said they were just always there, but she just didn't have focus on them. And then she said 8 years ago during my pregnancy, a dramatic change took place. She said, my parents-in-law lived here in the water mill and there was a desperate need of renovation. And apparently, she says, her father-in-law was waiting for them to have a child. Like, he needed to know that there was a male heir that was coming through. So she got pregnant and had the baby, and then he died like within 3 months after the baby was born. And they needed to move in and take over the property because her mother-in-law couldn't cope because they have animals in this big land space. And she said, about 2 months after her daughter was born, she felt this presence in the house. And she says, that was Miller, the house spirit. And she said, he confirmed to me that the beings of decay, who shortly before were still present in the water mill, had now moved out. And so Wolfgang's like, these beings of decay, like, what were they? What did they look like? And you saw them when you moved in? She's like, yeah, they're like weird gray looking spider webs that are almost like clouds of mist, but more like physical spider webs. And they're like elemental beings of decay when something dies. And she actually says that's my intuition, is that's maybe why people are so scared of spiders, because in another dimension, there's like some kind of elemental being that's responsible for decay and death. And that's the form it takes.
Like, what are the Stephen King with the Langoliers? It's like,
what's that?
So with him, it was like they would clean up time. Like they would chew up time after it was completed. It's the same kind of concept though. It's like an entity that consumes.
And later she explains the hierarchy that she learnt about in this house. It's a very strict hierarchy. The house head is this being called Miller. He just basically runs everything and all the other spirits are his subordinates. There's beings that are subject to him. And there's this lower level hierarchy, and the lower the entities are in the hierarchy, the more insignificant work they do. And some beings become so small, he explains that they're like atoms, but they still consciously exist in the house and have a certain task to do.
Which is?
Well, she doesn't really explain, like, I don't know, keep the dust away or something.
Yeah, it must have. Like, obviously, it would be a complex hierarchy.
And she talks about the green elementals, like plant spirits. It's the same thing. There's a very strict hierarchy where one entity takes care of the whole region, like it'll take care of the forest, but then there's one that takes care of the canopy, and then there's an entity that takes care of the ground, and then there's individual entities of the plants themselves. So she goes through this general hierarchy, and we've heard about this stuff before. But she's asked really specific questions by Wolfgang. He says, well, how many beings, for example, belong in this house of yours, in this hierarchy? And she's like, 16,743.
16,000?
16,000 entities getting around in your house.
That's going to make for a full house.
I don't know if our houses here in Australia would be the equivalent in entities to a fantastical German water mill in a beautiful forest.
Yeah, I doubt it.
Like, we probably have a few like drunk ones hanging around, like a dead goanna spirit or something. But I imagine we'd have many. And the reason she knows the specific number is the entity Miller tells her, like it puts the number in her head. And he asks her, well, do these entities, are they good or evil? And she says, well, you can't really think of them in terms of good and evil the way humans think of it. She says, she breaks it into six categories. So there's beings that are helpful towards humans. There's beings who are harmful towards humans. There's beings who are committed to growth, and there's beings who are committed to decay. There's beings entrusted with protection, and there's beings entrusted with destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that these people that perceive these things think about these entities, you can't think of them as like another dimension of human-like beings who have, you know, jobs and tasks and relationships, even though they have something a little bit like that. They're almost like the mechanisms that keep the world functioning. It's like without an entity for decay, the world would stop working because all the bodies would pile up.
Yep.
So we think of that in our material world as microbes breaking things down. But the idea is in another dimension, there's an intelligence that directs that.
Yeah, this is the animism of it.
Yeah, there's a spirit that makes sure all that runs perfectly. So we get into where Wolfgang has a Q&A with Miller, the house spirit. So he's like, how old are you? You know, where do you come from? Where were you born? He says, I'm a tree spirit. I was born in an oak tree in the Bavarian forest in 1267. I grew up there and stood as a tree close together with other trees. I was then felled, came to North Germany over a long and wet journey, and was installed as a beam in this mill in 1306. That's a long time to be in a house.
I'm also surprised, though, that it's conscious of our understanding of time. Like, it knows our, because I mean, we're the ones that have created that calendar.
Apparently it understands all this. It's been around humans for long enough.
Mm.
This is its explanation. Like, it understands humans. He asks how a tree spirit is born, and it says, well, when an acorn sprouts. Does a tree spirit remain connected to the felled oak? And he's like, yeah, they're like my brothers and sisters, and, you know, we have this kind of mental connection.
Do they leave?
Sorry?
Do they leave?
What do you mean?
Like, if that tree gets cut down and that timber gets burnt, like, does the spirit
die? Yeah, they die.
Okay.
They move on to something else. And the question is, well, what were the people like in the 13th century? In what way were they different to us people today? And Miller, the house spirit, says they were very, very different. They were more like herd animals. They had different eyes. They didn't have so much light in their eyes. They had a different smell. They had a group smell. They were rather like a herd of sheep. They were like tree branches. The tree had branches, and when the lowest branch broke off, a new one took its place. But the humans always stayed in the same group form. The entity said, I experienced the humans of the 13th century as groups, as members of a tribe. So the obvious question that follows is, well, what are we like today? He says, nowadays, humans are all like single trees.
Yeah. Because we don't live in tribes or anything like that.
We're not connected by all these branches. We're just all our own separate things. And he's asked like what his tasks are in the house. And he has to basically ensure that the house stays a house, that the floor stays level, that the beams stay straight. That's his most important task. And he has to check everything. He has to make sure everything's working. He has to check the house every day from top to bottom.
So is that suggesting if you have a home that starts needing repairs because it's, you know, breaking down, it's because the spirit has left?
In some instances, the spirit can leave, but it's more the case that the house spirit, this is what I've learned from reading this woman's interpretation, is that the house spirit's going, hello, we need to fix this. And because we're not aware of spirits, we have no idea.
Yeah, right.
And the house spirit is screaming at you, like, come on, you've got to
mold.
Do this. It might even try and get your attention. Like, it might knock something off a wall or make a certain sound in the house to try and make you realize what's going on. But we're just basically oblivious for the most part. And he then looks after the contact with the neighbors, he says, and he talks about, like, human neighbors, but also elemental neighbors. Like, one of them is named Eshevit, who's a water spirit, who, because it's a water mill, he basically lives in the river.
Right.
So he's like his pal. And Finally, he says, like, where does the name Miller come from? And he says, I thought of it myself. I thought of it myself. It's a super funny joke, yeah.
It took her 2 years.
And this
after.
German lady's like, what is a joke? So he then talks about, like, there's a certain point where they're talking about human bodies, and the house spirit says that Wolfgang should drink less coffee. And why? He says, well, why should I drink less coffee? And the house spirit says of what it does to your nerves, it makes your nerves red. I can see them.
So should he stop?
Well, this is what Wolfgang asks him, whether he should stop drinking so much coffee. And the house spirit just says, I don't care what you do. Like, whatever you want to do.
So why did it even bother telling him?
It's just, well, it just came up in conversation. He's a kind of a weird character. It's not like the way you would expect a woman to make up this fanciful character. Like, one of the characters...
Yeah, all the mundane details. It's kind of odd, isn't it?
One of the characters that comes through is this stone being, and he's just a dick. Like, he's really pompous and...
He thinks
he knows everything and that humans are idiots and he's just been around for so long, he knows everything.
Seems right for Stone.
So he says when your nerves don't have caffeine, he can see them and they're green. But if you have too much caffeine, they turn red and it's kind of bad for people. And then he's asked, can he leave the house? So you asked this earlier and he says, yes, he can leave the house. If he enters a piece of wood, he can be taken anywhere. But it's not good for the house. Now, he says the reason right. he can do this is because he's in touch with his humans. So he calls Verena and her husband his humans. And he will communicate with her and say, hey, you're going to the markets today. Can I come? And she'll be like, okay. She gets out a piece of wood and he's like, whoop. He jumps into the wood and she'll put it in her purse. And then she'll go off shopping and he'll be like, oh, what's going on? What are you buying? He likes a little trip out. Now, while
so she has a house pet.
She has a little piece of wood in her purse that he jumps into. And he leaves his underlings. He has two lieutenants that basically look after the house.
I was thinking, well, what happens to the house when he leaves?
Well, if he leaves the house for too long, it'll fall apart, basically. So he leaves his two deputies. And then he's asked, like, how long can you be away from the house? And he's just immediately, 62 hours. Like, very specific, 62 hours is the absolute maximum limit.
So why is it, though, that is it because, as you said, he was born in the tree which became the beam? So that beam, it's like the origin. It's like where he has to be.
Yeah, but somehow, because his nature is wood, he can still... It's like jumping in a car. It's like we can jump in a car and go somewhere. He needs a vehicle, and the vehicle is his piece of wood. And then we learn that he actually fights evil. Like, part of his job as the keeper of the house, as the house itself, is to fight the other ones. He calls them the other ones. Now, Wolfgang's like, well, are these demons? Like, what are they? And he says, I don't know. I just call them the other ones. Wolfgang says, what's their purpose? And he says, I don't know what they are or why they come. He says, all they want to do is destroy and I have to fight them. So this house spirit has to constantly be fighting against these things he calls the other ones, whose goal is to destroy the works of humans. So again, it's this whole idea of this other world that's this yin and yang that's always in balance and it's always like these two counter forces working against each other and with each other. And we're just completely unaware of it. But there's
we're very naive to it, clearly.
This battle of a watermill house with unseen entities that are trying to destroy it.
So could these entities then be a result for, hauntings, poltergeist activity? Could we just be misinterpreting these entities?
Well, he's actually asked that question later on. And the answer is something that we've understood for doing research on the show, where he just says, sometimes people get too attached to material things. And when they pass away, they can't move on to higher levels and they get stuck to the material thing that they're attached to.
Yep.
And that's why
so they stay in the house.
That's why haunted houses exist. Apparently, Wolfgang had just gotten back from Afghanistan and saw tens of thousands of destroyed houses. And he asks Miller about this. And the entity answers, well, that means there's a huge number of homeless house spirits in Afghanistan. And that's a huge problem for the country. He says, haunted castles are being built there now, haunted astral castles, which lead the humans living there to absorb this ghost-like substance.
What's the substance?
I have no idea. That's so weird about this.
Like teleplasm, ectoplasm.
Nothing's really ever explained. They have these super elaborate, complicated explanations for things. And I'm just left going, what the hell does that mean? What do you mean absorb a ghost substance from an astral castle in Afghanistan? What does that mean for your typical Afghani? What does it mean to have all these homeless house spirits everywhere?
What's the castle they're building?
What's happening in Ukraine with everything being destroyed? Is there just all these homeless house spirits walking around in Ukraine wondering what to do?
Well, it's any conflict. Like it's anyway. And think about the Second World War. I mean, how long does it last?
So again, it's this idea of like we see things in the material world, but there's this whole other layer that we just don't perceive.
God, think about Hiroshima. Think about it, like the entire city completely decimated and all the entities that would have been in those homes.
Now, it gets really, talking about complex and out there, listen to how he describes resting, because he talks about the house being his shelter, but he uses the mill that's attached to the house as his kind of bedroom. He goes to sleep in there. And he says, that's the folded up side of me, the point at which and in which I can't be touched from the outside. And he's like, what? When I sleep, I stretch myself out somewhere in the mill. I lie down with my humans in bed. But when I go into the refuge, I turn myself inside out. He says, that's like turning a square inside out so it becomes a cross. I move the outer surface inwards and the inner surface outwards, then I'm in anti-space and can regenerate myself. I'm just like, what am I reading? I thought this was going to be very whimsical. Like, I connect with the fairies and make sure the river's running. But he's like, no, I have to go into another quantum dimension and turn myself inside out so I can recharge my batteries. What is going on?
This is crossing into like the techno elves kind of stuff. Oh, it's super, a little bit DMT-esque.
It's super weird. And again, it's like this is a little old lady in Germany who's coming up with this stuff, if you believe that she's making it up. So he's then asked if he can imagine what it's like being a human, like seeing the world as a human. And he's like, I've already tried it. It's very boring. He hates it. And he's like, well, what were you doing? How did you do that? And he says he looked through Verena's eyes. He's like, it was very unsatisfactory.
So did he possess her? Is that what he's suggesting?
Yeah, he just basically inhabited her body, had a look through her eyes, didn't care for it, and just became the house spirit again. And then Wolfgang's like, well, what about my house? Is there an entity in my house? And Miller's like, yeah, but he doesn't like you. he actually hates your guts. And he's like, why? What did I do? And he's like, well, you really annoyed him. You must have altered something to do with a door.
Oh, so this is the Marie Kondo stuff. It's like you've actually got to ask your house spirit for permission, right? Before you do anything.
He says, look, your house spirit, I can see him. He's small and tubby. He's very well-natured, but he just hates you. He just hates your guts and you really annoyed him. And the house spirit Miller just says, yeah, did you paint a door or something? Like, what did you do? And he says, holy shit, yeah, I painted the hole around the door white. And Miller's like, that's it. He hates it.
You painted a hole.
Yeah, he painted.
Like one hole.
He painted it white. And so Wolfgang's like, how can I placate him?
It's
and
disgusting.
Miller says, you need to put out some milk chocolate for him.
It's so German.
Literally has to get some milk chocolate and put it out. And
but look at the parallels. It's like offering to the hungry ghosts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what you do for Santa Claus, right? You leave out some whiskey for him or something. And he later explains that what a house spirit enjoys is what the humans in the house enjoy. So if you are a fan of like, hot cocoa or something, you're meant to leave it out for a minimum of one night. And that makes the house spirit really happy. And so he'll look after your house even more. It'll give him energy. And so there is this idea.
Try this.
Leaving out something, like if your favorite food, you leave out some of your favorite food. He says, don't let it go moldy. Like just throw it out after a couple of days. But leave it out for your house spirit. And, eventually he starts talking to different entities. He starts talking to the watery one as well, who has been around since the Ice Age. And I might take a break here. We'll go into our plus extension and I'll just tell you a little bit about these guys coming up. The watery one's interesting because he seems to understand technology, right? And while they're recording this book, certain things go wrong with the tape recorder in some of the recordings.
Oh, that's incredible.
And so the watery one is asked, well, what happened with the tape recorder? Like, why did it fail yesterday? And this water spirit says, oh, we can't really control that because human technology is controlled by the gray ones. And
the gray ones.
See, he says the gray ones. And this comes up multiple times. And I'll mention this after the break. They keep referencing the gray ones in regards to technology. And they actually say, you have to take responsibility for the technology you've created and we can't get involved because the gray ones control it.
I mean, obviously we all know that it sounds like they're implying that it's the grays.
I don't know what they're talking about, but it's suspicious. It's suspicious.
You know, we've spoken about this concept that the grays deliberately seeded Earth with technology. And you sent me this great meme the other day where you're like, you're having a normal conversation with someone and you just suddenly drop in that transistors just suddenly appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah.
After the Roswell crash.
If you want to be a full-on schizo, yeah, that's what you do. So I'll talk about that after the break and mention some of the entities he gets in touch with. And the funniest thing is the husband. Like, the husband lives in the house as well. The husband has some perception of these entities as well. He can't see them, but he can kind of feel their presence and hear them sometimes. And he hates it. It's so annoying because he wants to do renovations on the house, right? And every time he does it without asking Miller, the house spirit, it goes wrong. Like, something doesn't work, it falls apart, or, you know, he gets the wrong material. It's just like it's cursed.
So what, he's got to get basically a medium or a house whisperer in every time that he wants to do some renovations?
Well, no, obviously he uses his wife. So he sits down with his wife and he's like, okay, you need to tell Miller that I need to fix the flooring in the upper story of the mill. And Miller's like, she'll basically say, oh, he's saying that's great. And okay, hang on. Yeah, he's saying we need the most expensive Italian tiles to do this renovation. And the husband's like, Italian tiles, that's going to cost a fortune. And apparently the house spirit is like, no, we're getting the best materials. Because imagine, it's like your body. Like, imagine if you're...
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you want the best.
You're going in for plastic surgery and they're like, oh, I can give you the discount tits for your tit job.
No one wants that.
The Italian ones are too expensive. And you're like, no, I want the Italian tits. Like, I don't want the cheap ones. That's what it's like. The house spirit doesn't want the crappy renovations. It wants the most expensive ones. And this poor husband is like, it's making me go broke. So in the back of my mind, I'm just like, the wife just wants.
Yeah. It's a clever way to get what you want.
And then I'm like, it is all in the mind. It is all the human brain.
Oh, so after all this, you finally come down to it's in the mind.
It is all in the brain. Right. It's all the human mind. But I will elaborate after the break. That's coming up for our Plus members. Sign up today if you want to get access to that. And of course, Aaron's got some incredible stuff coming up.
Crystal Shop Espionage.
Something about a yoni egg.
Poltergeist trapped in a yoni egg.
All right. That's worth the price of admission alone. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus for all the details. You get big access. You get big extensions on the end of the show.
Access to big extensions.
Every single week. And you're getting more than double the content if you sign up for Plus. You also get exclusive Plus shows every single Tuesday. You're also getting a totally ad-free version of the show. A higher bitrate version of the show as well. So better audio quality exclusive to Plus. Excuse me. And sign up for our MU Max tier as well, and you'll get access to our entire back catalog. Check it out today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. You're going to mention something?
Don't forget store.mysteriousuniverse.org. The Bigfoot lamps are back. These things have just been running out and our supplier ran out of them. And I had a few people that were very angry about it. They are back. store.mysteriousuniverse.org. Go and check it out.
You realize there's like a factory in Guangzhou somewhere.
No, they're made in America.
Are they?
Yeah, they're American made.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's a factory in Georgia somewhere. There's a bunch of American guys just laboring away because there's so many orders for Bigfoot lamps.
We have candles too now.
Bigfoot candles.
Yeah, we've got Bigfoot candles. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, just never underestimate the taste of Mysterious Universe listeners. That's a wrap for this show. Stick around if you're on Plus. For everyone else, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus Extension. Great to have you with us.